Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is December 1st. Okay, and I just want to go over the final schedule. Checking the final schedule. We are indeed scheduled to have it Monday the 15th at 10:30 right in here. And fortunately, that's what I have on your syllabus as well. All right, so Monday the 15th. So let's see, we have a lecture today and Wednesday and then Monday of next week. All right, so we got three lectures left.
Is it actually next Wednesday?
Next Wednesday? Yeah, this is correct. Yeah, we're not going to hold class a week from Wednesday because that's finals week and typically we don't give lectures during finals week. I think, depending on what community college it is, some community college allow their instructors to give lectures during finals week, but I don't know if Cypress College has that policy or not, but there won't be a lecture in here a week from Wednesday.
I'm curious about something though.
Yeah.
If there's no classes though on next Wednesday, though, isn't it also true that depending on what other classes a student has, there's a slight chance that
they might have a test during that time, and that's typically why we don't hold lectures. Yeah, there could be a test in another class during that time. Yeah, so usually we just reserve all of finals week for testing, lecture testing, and you don't have to go to lab either during finals week. But the lab instructors get paid, so if you want to go to lab and ask them questions on what you should be studying for the lecture part, then. Or if you want to look at models or whatever to help you see things for the lecture test, then of course you should go to lab too. But I got a feeling that's not going to be a very important issue for many people because I don't see many people in lab anyway, and even during the regular hours. So my guess is I won't see anybody during those labs. But so make sure that if you want to see your lab instructor during finals week, you make an appointment even though you're scheduled to have that lab during that time. Okay, now of course I'm going to have open lab tomorrow and Thursday, like always, right? So
the following, I
can't think that far ahead.
Okay.
If it's not during finals, yeah, I'll be there.
Okay.
Okay, if it's during finals week, then we'll have to talk and see what happens. All right, so let's see, what else did I do? I updated your course information or your course documents, depending on what class you're in, your lecture exam study guides, okay? Reloaded the one with the exam figures, so it has the arteries instead of the veins in the abdominal region, and then if you don't want to reload the whole thing, here's just that one JPEG for you to practice labeling. So, as a matter of fact, maybe I shouldn't try this, but I'm going to try and save this. Okay, so I'm going to try and save this because there's some... Now, in this Word document, there are links where you can practice some interactive exercises. I don't know if anybody has run into that yet, okay, which probably we're going to get to today. So I just want to download this thing. How about shortcut to 231? Yeah, okay. Look at that high-speed internet. Just cooking right along. Okay, well, it could be worse, right? Okay. All right, so maybe I'll show you some of this a little bit later. I'll just close. All right, so let's see. All right, so we're talking about the digestive system, and I think we were talking about surface area last time. What's a good common way for you to think of surface area? Surface area is the width times the height of something. But and did we measure surface area in this room?
Yeah.
Like what?
A door.
Yeah. So when I say surface area, you should actually think of it, okay, as a doorway for exchange. So where are two places where are we interested in understanding the doorway for exchange? Alveoli, the lungs, yeah, for getting respiratory gases in and out of our body. Where's another place? The digestive system, because you're going to be absorbing nutrients through that surface area, right, into your body. So you need a large surface area. Okay, so let's see. What is the surface area of your digestive tract? I have it right about here. All right, so when we speak of surface area scientifically, right here, what should you be thinking of in everyday language? Surface area is equal to, especially in the digestive system, it's equal to, in everyday language, what is it? What did we measure in this room? Not a door, because a door is going to block something, but it's what? A doorway. A doorway, yeah, or a passageway for things for exchange to take place. All right, so what are the three structural features of the small intestine that increase the surface area for absorption? We learned three things. So what makes the small intestine a lot larger? Right, if we were to flatten all these things out. It's got to be some kind of folds, right? It's got to be some kind of folds. What were the folds? There's a gross fold, there's almost something that's microscopic fold, and then there's definitely something, another microscopic fold that increases the surface area of the small intestine. So let's start with the big one.
Are you referring to the three parts that actually make?
Yeah, the three things that increase the surface area of the small intestine, which enhances absorption. Is microvilli is one, microvilli, okay, but microvilli is the smallest thing. That's the microscopic structure. So if you take out all those microvilli, flatten them out on the surface of the cell, you make the cell longer, okay. Goblet cells secrete mucus, but they don't really increase the surface area. What else did we have? It's on this slide right here. So here's microvilli, right? We could flatten all these microvilli out. That would make this cell larger for absorption. What else? Look at all these villi right here. All right, look at all these villi. We could flatten those out as well. That increases the surface area. And what's another thing that we could flatten out? So here are the villi. We could flatten out all of the plicae circulari, or the circular folds in the small intestine, to make the small intestine flat. All right, so those are the three things, the plica circularis, the villi, and the microvilli. If we flatten all those things out, how much longer would the intestine be? Or what would the surface area be? Okay, the surface area of the small intestine is about 3.5 square feet if it was a simple straight tube. But we know it's not just a simple straight flat tube. What does it have? It has the plicae circularis, it's got villi, and it's got microvilli. So you got to make that nice list in your mind. All these different folds, right? So all of these folds increases the surface area to 2,200 square feet. Right? That's 240 square meters. That's a huge surface area. That's like the floor area of a standard two-level house. That's a huge surface area. I don't think my house is even that big, 2,200 square feet. But at least my digestive tract has that surface area for absorbing nutrients, so I guess I don't feel too bad, especially after last week. All right, so don't forget, capillaries absorb amino acids and sugars, but what absorbs fat? Do you see it on this slide right here? It is the lacteal, right? Here's that, and a lacteal is just a specialized lymphatic capillary that's specialized for absorbing fat from the digestive tract. All right, let's think of something else here happening with the digestive tract, and that is in the stomach. What's the function of the stomach again?
Storage
and mixing. Not a lot of digestion, an initial protein digestion, right? But that's about it, and no absorption. Almost no absorption whatsoever. Only certain kinds of strange compounds can be absorbed by the stomach. So how does the food that we eat end up as being chyme? You have to chew it. You got to masticate it. It gets in the stomach, and your stomach then adds what to it? Gastric juice, right? Gastric juice. And what I'm trying to get at is how much gastric juice? How much gastric juice every day is poured into your stomach? 1.5 liters, all right? So what would happen if you were to lose 1.5 liters of fluid every day? What would happen to you? You would dehydrate, okay? So I just want you to remember that. All right, 1.5 liters from go into the stomach. Now, what about the small intestine? How much fluid is secreted into the small intestine every day from intestinal glands? Okay, where do I have that? Do I have that anywhere? 1.8. So now we're up way past 3 liters a day. For sure you would dehydrate. All right. Okay, so then that's going to take us to the function of the large intestine. All right, so the function of the large intestine is no digestion taking place. Because who's doing the job of digestion? The small intestine is digesting. Plus, what else is the small intestine doing? It is absorbing nutrients that are digested. So probably if you want to have a feel for that process, you should know what the building blocks of proteins are. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. And the building block of complex carbohydrates like starch or glycogen. Those are simple sugars. Your body absorbs simple sugars just like it absorbs amino acids. And the building block of fats would be fatty acids. All right, and those are all absorbed from the small intestine. They're important energy sources. All right, so the small intestine, digestion as well as absorption. But now, what about the large intestine? No digestion. Well, if no digestion is taking place, what good is the large intestine? Okay. Elimination. Yeah, but it's this big, long structure. All right, let's move to... All right, here is the large intestine. If it was just a tube for passing digested material, it wouldn't have to look like this. All right, so there's something going on right here. What the heck is going on? So it is the absorption, right? There's no digestion taking place right here under normal circumstances, but the absorption of water and salt. Because how much water have we put into the intestinal tract so far? Yeah, almost 3 liters, over 3 liters of fluid. You can't afford to lose that 3 liters of fluid because you're going to dehydrate right away. All right, so the job of the large intestine and the shape of the large intestine is such that it absorbs water from chyme as it moves from the ileum, okay, into the cecum right here. All right, then you have the ascending colon, the transverse colon, descending colon, and then you have these different flexures, right, like the hepatic flexure over here. Why do we call this the right colic flexure, the hepatic flexure? Because the liver is over there, and this is the splenic flexure because the spleen is on the left side. Descending colon, then here we have a segment of the sigmoid colon going into the rectum and anal canal. And we have some smooth muscles. Okay, what do we call a circular smooth muscle? A sphincter. So we have a sphincter between the small intestine and the large intestine. We call that the ileocecal valve or sphincter between the ileum and the cecum. There is an internal anal sphincter, right, which is circular smooth muscle, and an external anal sphincter, which is skeletal muscle, which you have under your conscious control. Okay. So the job of this large intestine right here is to absorb salt and water so you do not dehydrate. But there's another function of the small intestine, and that is there are lots of things living in that large intestine, like, for instance, bacteria. Right. There's a natural biotic environment of bacteria, and they're important bacteria because they produce vitamins for us. All right, so we do absorb vitamins from the large intestine when non-digested material that we can't digest.
Is that the intrinsic factor?
Okay, that's secreted by the stomach. Intrinsic factor is secreted by the stomach. But, for instance, okay, do I have some examples? So, you know, I guess I don't have any example. Vitamin K, in particular, necessary for blood clotting function. All right, so you have blood clotting disorder if you don't have vitamin K, and it's helped produced by bacteria in the large intestine. Okay. All right, so no nutrients should enter the large intestine because whose job is it to digest and absorb? Small intestine, right? And the small intestine is in control of the stomach, When the small intestine is ready to accept more material from the stomach, it signals the stomach and the stomach contracts, the pyloric valve relaxes, and chyme is pushed into the small intestine for absorption. But if the stomach, if the small intestine is real busy, then the small intestine inhibits the stomach. So the stomach is there just to hold on to everything that you eat until the small intestine is ready to work on it. But every once in a while, the small intestine doesn't do its job properly, and nutrients enter the large intestine. What happens when nutrients enter the large intestine? Okay. That means that the small intestine isn't doing its job properly. Okay, what happens to all those nutrients in the large intestine then? They're not absorbed by your body. Yeah, so they don't have any nutritional value to you. Okay, I agree. But they don't go straight out. They're not wasted. They're absorbed and used as an important energy source for somebody else. Who else is there? All those millions of bacteria. Right, and so when they receive all those nutrients, instead of having millions of bacteria, guess what happens? You produce billions of bacteria, right? They go nuts. They have a party. They start producing gas and irritability of the large intestine. Okay, and what does that produce? Besides gas, it's going to produce copious amounts of watery diarrhea. Okay, and so what do we call that? That is what we call malabsorption syndrome. When you don't absorb nutrients, they go to the large intestine, and there's plenty of bacteria there to say, thank you very much, we're going to get busy and enjoy this stuff. But, okay, why is that really a bad thing for you? Because now, remember, the job of the large intestine is to absorb water, but if that material isn't staying in the large intestine for you to absorb that water, you're going to be losing all that water and salt. You're going to have electrolyte imbalance and water imbalance. And, as a matter of fact, you know what? Probably more people die of malabsorption syndrome or infections of the large intestine than any other disease in the world. More people die of diarrhea than pretty much almost anything else. And it's not people our age. What people are most susceptible? Elderly, but even more so would be infants, right? And so, can you think of what would be a reason why an infant would come down with diarrhea? Actually just drinking contaminated water, just drinking water that's not safe to drink. So that just sort of gives you a little bit of an insight, you know, what the state of the world is. You could probably save more people's lives just by figuring out how to get clean drinking water to everybody to prevent diarrhea and dehydration. All right, so that kind of underscores the importance of the large intestine right here. So what do you got to know? Well, you got to know the appendix and the cecum. And these pouches right here are what we call haustra. This line is the tinea coli. That's an anchor point for smooth muscles for peristalsis. And then there are these little things, epiploic appendages. They're labeled on your diagram, but nobody has a clue as to what they're doing there. So that's something you'd look forward to later on. Somebody might find out what these are. There's something else about the large intestine besides misbehaving. Oh, how is malabsorption syndrome kind of, it can be produced by something else in our population relatively easily. And that is some people, remember when, maybe I didn't talk about this very much, but in physiology that's real important. For instance, if I write lactose on the board, OSC, that means that's a sugar. Anytime you see an OSE at the end of a word, that means it's a sugar. There's another suffix that we can put at the end of the word called lactase with an ASC. That doesn't mean that it's a sugar, but it kind of looks like lactose. That means that it's a protein and in particular an enzyme. All right, and an enzyme will digest things down, can break things down or build things up. In particular, this enzyme right here will break lactose down into simple sugars that we can absorb from our small intestine. But without this enzyme, lactose can't be broken down and we can't absorb that in the small intestine. And then where does lactose go? Large intestine. And then who says thank you very much? All those bacteria producing lots of gas, copious amounts of watery diarrhea. That is what we call malabsorption syndrome. And as we get older, right, our bodies stop producing lactase. Right, so if we eat a lot of dairy products, because lactose is an important sugar in dairy products, all right, we too can get malabsorption syndrome if we eat a lot of ice cream or sugar, cottage cheese, things like that. Yeah.
Couldn't that also happen from those that are like lactose intolerant?
And then there are people where they have an early onset of a deficiency in lactase, maybe in their teens or something. Okay, but probably everybody is going to have to deal with that at some point in their life. Okay, the onset is earlier than others to some people. Okay, and so here's something else that's interesting. There are basically three kinds of food groups. There are fats, sugars, proteins. Which ones have the most energy per gram? Okay, I think sugars are maybe about 4, proteins are about 4. Calories or kilocalories per gram, and fats, you know what? More than double for the same weight. All right, so people who are interested in losing weight maybe want to restrict their diet of fats because they can eat the same pound for pound of sugar and proteins, but they'll probably lose weight as a result of that. So somebody came up with a really bright idea and said, well, let's design a drug, and actually it happens fairly frequently, let's design a drug that will block the absorption of fat from your, where do you absorb fat from? What part of your anatomy do you absorb fat from? Where does absorption and digestion and absorption take place? Small intestine. Okay, so let's design a drug that's going to block the absorption of fat. Oh, what part of the small intestine even? The lacteal, right? That's that inner part of a villus. Let's design a drug that will block absorption of that fat. And then people like me, I could eat bacon all day long and ice cream, things that are high in fat, and then I don't have to worry about all that extra energy that I'm getting because I won't absorb it. Does that sound like a good idea? Oh, why not? I kind of thought that would be a great idea. Why would that be a bad idea? Because, you say that again? You need some fat, yeah, for absorption of like vitamins and things like that, fat-soluble vitamins, and your body does need some fat. So, okay, but I'll just take a little bit of the drug so it blocks some of it, but I still get to get a little fat in my diet. Why is that still a bad idea? Because that fat, if you don't absorb it, goes to the large intestine. And who's in that large intestine? And they say thank you very much, and what do they produce? Okay, yeah, diarrhea, but not copious amounts of watery diarrhea, copious amounts of watery, oily diarrhea. Okay, so you go, ooh, that's even worse, and it is worse. Okay, it is so much worse that people that are on this medication, does anybody know what this is called? Xenical. Xenical is what it was called a number of years ago. People that are on Xenical have no idea when they're stooling themselves. Have the slightest idea. So what do you have to do when you don't know when you're going to stool yourself? You got to wear a diaper. Diaper when you're in class taking notes or in class giving a lecture, driving down the 405 freeway. So they finally realized that that's a really bad drug, so people stopped taking it, but then they reintroduced it at a lower dose so that the side effect isn't so severe, and that's called, I don't know how they pronounce it, ally or something like that. Okay. So it probably does work because there's so much energy in fats, but there's side effects. And the other thing you have to be concerned about, of course, is absorbing the other nutrients, like vitamins that you need that come along with lipids. Yeah.
So how does that still work? Does it block off the lacteal ability?
You know, really good question. I'm going to have to Google it. I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. I never learned. But it is interesting. How does it block the absorption? It might block because... fats have to be packaged before they can be absorbed, so maybe it blocks the packaging, or maybe it binds the lipids onto a particle. So, I'm not really sure. It puts a special coat over the protein, over the lipids. Okay, yeah, but I would have to look. But that's sort of, that's all interesting pharmacology. That's interesting pharmacology, and. Okay, something else about the large intestine. Okay, this sigmoid region right here, there are, I think, I don't know what the latest figure is, but there are about 20,000 people just in the United States that die of colon cancer every year. So I think that's a huge number. But it's really even worse because colon cancer is curable, right? And it's completely preventable, number one, and curable, number two. And the way that you cure and prevent colon cancer is with routine exams, right? Either a sigmoidoscopy or a colonoscopy. So it's really a shame that all these thousands, tens of thousands of people are dying just in the United States because they're not taking advantage of the medical care that we have here, or maybe they don't have the proper medical care. So basically just a camera and a little light is inserted into the rectum and it follows the curvature around through the sigmoid colon. That's what's called a sigmoidoscopy, right? And colonoscopy goes up to the splenic flexure over here and investigates and looks for tumors or the precursors to tumors. These things are not cancerous, but they're called polyps. All right, so if a polyp is ever found, then there's a little instrument in there that can snip it off right away, and then they put it in a little test tube and send it off to the lab to see if it is cancerous. But if it's caught early, it usually never is, and then that person won't develop colon cancer as a result of that. Yeah. Oh, I've seen some infomercials on colon cleansing and things like that. I was hoping nobody would ask me about colon cleansings or high colonics and things like that, but I did tell you how interesting the digestive system is, right, from this point of view. And what's your question regarding that? It seems awfully unnatural to me, too. Yeah, I would agree with you. I probably wouldn't buy products like that, okay, or do anything similar in the privacy of my own home with my only myself. I probably wouldn't do such things because it seems highly unnatural to me. And, you know, this digestive system evolved through millions of years of evolution. Something that we come up with in the last 5 years is probably really not going to affect, you know, how our system is designed to work as long as you have a proper diet. You have to have some bulk in your diet, right? So I know a lot of people kind of focus in on that, and yeah, I don't think it can be I don't know if it can really hurt you. Certainly, I don't think it's good for you.
Once you have colon cancer,
yeah,
they do surgery.
They resect.
They cut.
They go chop here, sew it back together, and hopefully, if they do find colon cancer, they can make just a small cut. And so you don't lose a lot of function. But usually people recover pretty well if they get that cancer early enough. Yeah.
I know somebody that doesn't have a colon at all.
Yeah? They can put in a colostomy tube.
Well, no. They
Oh, that's interesting. We should talk about that sometime because they probably have to watch their fluid balance.
Well, he said that. He's a brain surgeon, actually.
Yeah. Wow. So it changes your life, not necessarily in a really good way. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, so it's real important to get that screening done, depending if you have family history that determines when you should get it done and how often it should be done. And we're talking about cleansing the large intestine, right? The sigmoidoscopy and colonoscopy are not terribly difficult procedures to go through. But the preparation is not really all that much fun. Because if someone wants to look around inside your large intestine, it has to be what?
Clean.
It has to be clean. So that's the difficulty with that kind of exam. And your physician prescribes what their favorite method is for cleansing. Sometimes enemas are. Sometimes you drink something. And what you drink has kind of a cruel name to it. It's called Go Lightly. Okay, Go Lightly. And that's like not what you're going to do at all, okay? You're going to go profusely and heavily, but that's a good thing, okay? And it's called lightly, not because of light that, you know, or heaviness, it's because of electrolytes. It has a special electrolyte balance because if you were to drink a gallon of water, that could maybe be fatal. So there has to be salts to maintain electrolyte balance in your body, which again kind of underscores the importance of the large intestine, maintaining your water balance and electrolyte balance. These are things we get into in a physiology class. Okay. So if you have a choice, Remember, the two exams I said was a sigmoidoscopy versus a colonoscopy. Colonoscopy is a little bit more extensive, right? You might require some light anesthesia for that to happen. But a lot of times when people get a sigmoidoscopy, they might find something and a physician can't make up his mind if it's dangerous or not. Guess what you have to do again? You got to go through another preparation, come back another day for a colonoscopy. So if you have a choice, just tell your physician, I'm not interested in a sigmoidoscopy. Let's just get it over with the first time and just do the colonoscopy. And also, that kind of underscores another point, when you prepare yourself for one of these exams, you want to do a fantastic job or a so-so job? Yeah, because if you do a so-so job, guess what? You're going to get another prescription and say, well, you got to come back and do it again. And you'll probably realize, oh, well, probably should have did it. I should have done it right the first time, right? So that's something else. The anesthesia is really nice, all right? I forget what it's called, but it's very fast-acting. And when things have a fast action in your body, usually the duration is very short as well. So, and the side effects are very minimal. It's not Percocet, it starts with a P, but I forget what it's called. Okay, and the procedure is they'll establish a little IV, they'll give you a little of the anesthetic, and the person giving you the anesthetic will say, okay, count down from 10 to 1. And I think it goes something like 10, 9, 8, and then it's like somebody's tapping you on the shoulder, saying, okay, time to wake up, and you go, well, I only got to about 8. And it's over, okay? So it's really nice. Because there's smooth muscle in the large intestine, and any time you distend that smooth muscle, it's going to respond by contracting, all right? So there's really no reason why you should be conscious during this exam, unless you want to see what's going on. But that's not a big deal, because they can always put it on videotape and burn a CD for you, and you can take it home. Okay, so there's no reason why you should really experience why anybody's poking around in your large intestine. All right, so that's the large intestine, kind of overlooked but very important organ in your body. All right. Any other questions? Well, let's move on to the liver. I think you had to know a lot about the liver in lab. All right, but it produces bile in terms of the digestive system. Bile has a couple of functions. It neutralizes acids. Where do acids come from? From the stomach, right? From chyme that's produced in the stomach. So the pH of the small intestine is up near 8, so the pH has to shift radically from about pH 2 in the stomach all the way up to 8, which is past neutrality. It becomes more basic. Bile salts help neutralize stomach acids, but the bile salts, just as importantly, emulsify fat for digestion and absorption. Fats are, well, they're oils, and if you put a drop of oil on water, what's going to happen? Is it going to dissolve in that water just like if you put sugar or something? No, it's just going to float on the top, right? So when we have fats in our diet, they can't be digested until they're broken down into really tiny microscopic particles, and that's the job of bile salts. We call that emulsification, and that just allows digestive enzymes. That kind of compound, fat, another name for a fat is a lipid. Okay, what's the name of an enzyme that can break a lipid down, that can digest a lipid? Okay, you're really close, because all you got to do is put an A-S-E on the end of the word. Okay, but lipase. So it's abbreviated a little bit. There's no ID on the end of it, but that's really close. Okay, lipase. And what kind of enzyme will break down a protein? A protease, right? Okay, a protease. Okay. So that won't be on your test. Let's see, bile duct anatomy. Yeah, you do have to know the bile duct anatomy, especially in lab as well. Here it is. All right, so don't forget, this is the right side of the body. So the liver is right up over here. The gallbladder is tucked right up underneath the inferior margin of the liver. Very easy to separate if you separated it in your cats in a normal circumstance. All right, so the liver is producing bile. So here are the right and left hepatic ducts coming from the right and left lobes. They anastomose to form the common hepatic duct. If you are in a fed state, then those bile salts are going to move right down from the common hepatic duct through the common bile duct into the pancreatic duct and then into the small intestine, because this is where we need to neutralize stomach acids. But if you're in a fasted state, bile is secreted right and left hepatic duct into the common hepatic duct, and instead of going down through the common bile duct, they're going to be transported via the cystic duct into the gallbladder. So the gallbladder is just a storage place for bile salts, and when you start eating, especially lipids again, there are signals that are going to tell the gallbladder to contract, squishing out bile salts into through the cystic duct into the common bile duct and then into the small intestine. Yeah.
I'm just so curious, but isn't there like a certain like some sort of like liquid though that the secreted though that causing the stool to turn green?
The green color. Maybe. You know, I don't know where that green came from. I'm just really not big on these colors of things. Okay. So that could be biliverdin from the breakdown of red blood cells, hemoglobin. Okay. And viridin is kind of ringing a bell. Viridin, viridase, has kind of a green maybe color to it. Okay. Before it's converted to bilirubin, which is yellow. All right. So liver can store a number of vitamins that are fat soluble, namely vitamin A, B12, D, E, and K. It can store some minerals, copper and iron, for us. And it can also store glycogen. Now, glycogen is not lipid soluble. Glycogen is a storage form of glucose. So if we have a glucose molecule bound to another glucose, bound to another glucose, right, thousands of times over, this is what we call glycogen. All right, and then there's an enzyme that can break this bond here and take this glucose and put it in the blood. So this helps regulate blood glucose in your body. When you're in a fasted state, you don't run out of glucose because there is glycogen in your liver, and the liver can break it down one molecule at a time and put it in your circulatory system to maintain your blood glucose. Anybody know what kind of hormones are involved in regulating blood glucose? They act on the liver. There is insulin and glucagon. And you don't have to know anything about that, but maybe in the next class we'll have to learn something about that. Okay, so that's glycogen, stores sugar in your body. The liver has some important chemical functions, in that it helps convert a precursor form of vitamin D into a more active form of vitamin D, and vitamin D is necessary for you to absorb calcium from your diet. It helps convert fat into phospholipids. All cell membranes are made out of phospholipids, so you need lots of phospholipids in your body. It can convert amino acids to sugar, and it can convert protein and sugar into fat when you have a lot of both of those. Breakdown product of proteins is ammonia, which is highly toxic, so the liver can detoxify it into urea. Urea is less toxic, but it is still toxic, but your kidneys are able to excrete it. Kidneys can't excrete ammonia because it just goes everywhere in your body. There's no way for kidneys to take it out. But urea can be taken out by the kidneys, and then you excrete it when you void. And the liver is also important for the synthesis of blood clotting factors. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about blood clotting factors. Okay, but is it important to have good blood clotting function? Yeah, because if you don't, even with a small paper cut, you could bleed to death, right? So it's very important to have proper blood clotting function. All right, so that's pretty much it for the digestive system. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the urinary system. So I don't know if I forgot to mention this or not, but nonetheless, you know, if you guys ever end up in a clinical setting and you got to take these medical education hours to keep your certification current, did I mention this before? If anybody's ever giving a lecture on the digestive tract, you should go and listen to it, because it's always fascinating, and these folks usually have an exquisite sense of humor, talking about the digestive system all the time and dealing with it day in and day out. Okay, urinary system. Well, what are the components of the urinary system? There's only four. You got the kidneys that produce urine. You've got the urinary bladder that stores urine until the proper time for voiding. There's a tube between the kidneys and the urinary bladder. That's what we call the ureters. And then the exit from the body is via the urethra. Okay, the functions of the urinary system. Well, we could probably guess what some of the functions are. Remove waste products from the blood, for instance, like urea, which we mentioned previously. But here are some things that are maybe not so obvious. It helps control blood volume for long-term regulation of blood pressure, because the major part of urine is water, and that water comes out of your blood. And if we take water volume out of your blood, what happens to your blood pressure? Okay, and I suppose it could be really simple. If you look at the tires on your car and they look flat, okay, what could you tell me about the pressure inside those tires? Is it high pressure or low if they're flat? They're low. So if you want to increase the pressure, what do? Do you put air in or do you take air out? You put air in, right? Same thing for your circulatory system. If your blood pressure is too high, if you take volume out, if you take water out of your blood vessels, your blood pressure decreases. Or if your blood pressure is too low, what do? You put fluid in to maintain your blood pressure. Hence, when somebody's suffering from a hemorrhage on the way to the hospital, what's one of the ways that we can help support their life? Yeah, we can establish an IV and give them fluids to boost their blood pressure back up, right? This maybe not going to help their oxygen carrying capacity because there's no red blood cells, but at least they'll have good blood pressure, and that will help oxygen delivery. All right, the kidney also regulates electrolyte levels in your body. What the heck is an electrolyte? Like, for instance, it's an ion, like a sodium ion or a potassium or calcium chloride ions. These are all electrolytes, right? L-Y-T-E. All right, remember we talked about go lightly. That's how it's spelled on that jug, right, that you have to drink for that colonoscopy. Electrolyte. Another time you might be working in the emergency room and somebody's going to yell right away, we need some lights on this patient right away. We need some lights, stat. So what are you going to do? Grab a bunch of spotlights and shine it on the person? What do they mean? No, they mean that you should take some blood, get some blood, take it to the lab and measure their electrolytes, like their potassium, sodium, chloride, et cetera, right? So that's an electrolyte. So it has important electrical properties inside the body. The kidney also regulates pH. That's determined by the hydrogen ion concentration. And it also controls red blood cell production. What kind of tissue makes red blood cells? Did we talk about that? I think maybe. Bone marrow. What kind of bone marrow? Red bone marrow in particular, right? Because yellow bone marrow is just a storage form for lipid. Okay, so what about the kidneys? Okay, let's look at a picture. Okay, so here are the components. Here you can see the two kidneys. They're bean-shaped. They're about as big as your fist. And the interesting thing is that they're embedded in the muscles of the back. They're surrounded by some perirenal fat that help protect them from trauma. But they are behind the peritoneal membrane. So the peritoneal membrane is a serous membrane that helps form that surrounds the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity. So hence we say that the kidneys are retroperitoneal, meaning they're outside the peritoneum. So they're not just squishing around with all the rest of your intestines. All right, so these are the structures that produce urine, which then flow through the ureters into the urinary bladder, and then when you void, it exits the urethra right here. So those are the main parts of the kidney. I'm not going to talk about that very much. Okay, gross structures of the kidney. On the outside, we have the renal capsule. So you got to really pay attention to some terminology. It can be maybe a little bit confusing until you see how it's used. But the capsule is the connective tissue sheath surrounding the kidney. And if we slice open the kidney, we can see that there are definite structures associated with the kidney. These things that are triangular shaped, like this thing right here. So here is the apex of this kidney. Of the pyramid. And then over here is the base. So since it looks like a pyramid, we actually call them the pyramids. And these things contain the structural and functional unit of urine formation. All right, so I want to write on the board structural and functional unit of urine formation. So if you know how this thing works, you know how pretty much how most of the kidney works. All right, structural and functional unit of urine formation. Okay, does anybody know what that is? Well, that's why we're here today. This is what we call the nephron. Okay, so the answer is nephron. So we got to learn a lot about the nephron in here. We're going to talk about some gross anatomy first before we get to the nephron. So what makes up these pyramids right here? You're going to say nephrons. Yeah, many, many, many nephrons. Okay. And in between the pyramids, we have some columnar structures that carry blood vessels, so we call those the columns, the renal columns, and renal pyramids. All right, and like for every organ, there's a superficial part and a deep part. And the superficial part is always going to be called the cortex, and the deep part is going to be called the medulla. And the pyramids are in the medulla, and the cortex, you can see just a bunch of blood vessels right here, at least on this slide. So here, it just underneath the capsule is the cortex, and deep to the cortex is the medulla. Okay. The pyramids are going to be producing urine, all right, and that urine is going to be secreted from the pyramid into a tube that's going to collect the urine. And one little tube that comes off of a pyramid is what we call a calyx, right? And the tip of a pyramid is what we call a papillae. So here is here's a papilla right here. Here is a calyx. And this one right here, since it's coming just from one pyramid, we call that a minor calyx. When a number of minor calyces join together, then we call that a major calyx. Right, so a minor comes from one pyramid, a major comes from a number of them. And here you can see the tip of a pyramid coming from what underneath the slide, secreting urine right at you. All right, so that's what this little structure is. So we got minor calyx, major calyx, and then a major calyx is going to empty blood into, urine into the renal pelvis, which is this funnel-shaped structure right here. And from the pelvis, then it's going to find its way into the ureter, down to the urinary bladder. Okay, the entrance right here to the kidney, you can see there's an indentation in the kidney, and this indentation contains the renal pelvis, the renal artery, renal vein, and there's even nerves that enter the kidney at this point. So this entryway right here is what we call the hilum of the kidney. Is it on this diagram anywhere? Do you see it anywhere? No. I think you have to know this on your list. All right, and the hilum is just the attachment point of the kidney to the body, the rest of the body. So if this were actually a kidney bean, right, the place where the kidney bean attaches to the mother plant is actually called the hilum or the hilus of that bean too. It's like the attachment point of that umbilicus. And if you look at a kidney bean, you can see that it actually has a little white spot or white dot right there. That's where it was connected to the bean pod at one time. Okay, so we got the pelvis right here. We can also see some places that are way deep inside the medulla. Okay, like right in this region right here, and probably maybe in this region over here, this region right here. It's inside the kidney, but it's outside of a calyx, and it's outside the renal pelvis, but there's a space, and there's fat inside the space. This is what we call the renal sinus. Right, so the sinus is all the space deep inside the medulla that's not inside a blood vessel of any kind and not inside a calyx of any kind. It's just a space inside the kidney. All right, so how does blood get to where it's going? Well, it comes in the renal artery, right, and then the first branch is what we call a lobar artery. That's the first branch. And then the lobar arteries break into the interlobar arteries, which go up through the columns, and then, right, it forms the arcuate arteries up over here, and then the arcuate arteries form the interlobar, right, and then they finally branch into the interlobular arteries. All right, so there's a little bit of detail on that particular diagram. All right, so what did we need to talk about? I guess we talked about all this. Okay, pretty good. All right, let's start talking about the nephron. And you have a pretty good picture of a nephron in your book. Here's a picture of it. There's another kind of picture of it. All right, but the picture that I really like for you to appreciate, oh, I downloaded already. All right, let's go to the desktop. Okay. Oh no, I maybe saved it in here. Look on the bottom. I hope this is it. That's not it. Study guide, 231 study guide. Here. Okay. So here are all the figures that you got to know, and we're going to get to the, oh look, here's a little interactive exercise, right, that you can practice labeling. So if you do control click on that, oh, I don't have a control button. That provides you with a little interactive exercise. And of course, here's the arteries and the, here's another little interactive exercise that you can practice labeling. Okay, lymphatic system. Oh, I want to show you that diagram too. Respiratory system. We're close. Okay, pancreas. Who hasn't started labeling these things yet? I'm not going to turn around and look. Okay, another interactive exercise right there. Aha! No. Ah. Here we go. All right, so here's a picture of the nephron, okay, that I want you to know. And the nephron can be broken down into two main structures, two ways to think about the nephron. All right, so the first thing that a nephron has is that it has vascular elements. Bless you. So what does that mean? Vascular elements. What does that mean? Blood vessels, right? And the second thing that it has are tubular elements. Tubular elements. So we're going to talk about these things, so you got to know how, you should just draw this nephron out, okay, and then label it. All right, so as far as the vascular elements are concerned, okay, we have a blood vessel right here that is taking blood to this nephron. So here is the nephron. So here is a blood vessel, and it's nicely color-coded red, so that's an arteriole. That's a small, small artery. This is what we call the afferent arteriole. That's going to take blood to a special capillary. And that special capillary is this thing right here. So it's a network. And that's a very leaky capillary filled with fenestrated capillaries, which means what? It has holes, it has windows, so a lot of fluid can leak out. That thing right there is what we call the glomerulus. That's the glomerulus. And what the heck is a glomerulus again? If we were going to classify it, is that an artery, a vein, or?
Capillary.
It's a capillary. All right, that's a capillary. And then all those capillaries are going to anastomose and form another blood vessel right here. And you can see it's color-coded red because that's another arteriole. That's what we call the efferent arteriole. Right there. It's taking blood out of the glomerulus. All right. And then our last vascular element is that it flows from that efferent arteriole to another capillary bed. So there's another network of capillaries right there that you can see in red and blue. And they're surrounding the tubules of the nephron, so we call these the tubular capillaries. So this is sort of interesting because how many capillary beds do you see back to back? You see two. And usually, what do you find in your body? Just one. So what do we call a vascular system that has two capillary beds back-to-back interconnected with another tube? That's a portal system, right? So that's just a special delivery system. All right, so these are all the vascular elements right here. All right, let's talk about the tubular elements in this process. Yeah? Yeah, it's an arteriole. I have to maybe look at exactly what I have in my notes right there. But it's a portal vessel. Sorry, it's a portal vessel because it's going between two capillary beds. Yeah. The portal system, you know, I would say, I would say all of them, but it would be picky to say it would be glomerulus, efferent arteriole, and the peritubular capillaries. But everything that's in this circuit right here. So I would maybe start with the afferent arteriole, okay? And then probably, all right, this is going to go to the renal vein out over here. So depending on the extent of the description that's necessary. But this is the portal system because there are two capillary beds. Here's the first one. Here's the second one. Before it goes back to the heart, okay? Okay, tubular elements. Blood, plasma, is going to leak out of these glomerular capillaries because they're highly leaky. And they're just not going to leak into the kidney. They're going to be collected by the structure that is surrounding the glomerulus. And that's what we call Bowman's capsule. Or another word would be glomerular capsule. All right, so let's just say the first part of the tubular element is going to be Bowman's capsule. Or what's another name? Glomerular capsule. Okay, but did we run into a capsule before? Yeah, we ran into something called the renal capsule. Where's the renal capsule? And is that what I have on the slide right here? No, the renal capsule surrounds the kidney. Okay, that's a connective sheath around the kidney. But the glomerular capsule, or Bowman's capsule, is the first part of the tubular element of the nephron. All right, so it's picking up plasma, and about 20% of the plasma that flows into the nephron ends up in Bowman's capsule. All right, so can you afford to lose 20% of your blood volume like that? No. So you can imagine the job of the rest of the nephron is to resorb that water, put it back into your blood before you run out of blood volume. Okay, so that material, that plasma that leaks into Bowman's capsule is not what we call plasma, and it's not urine. It's going to eventually maybe part of it become urine, but it's what we call filtrate. Because the process by which plasma leaks out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule is called filtration. That's the first step. Okay. All right, so then filtrate is going to move its way through this twisty, turny little tube right here, this little pipe. What do we call something that has a lot of twists and turns? It's called convoluted. And this is the first one that's closest to Bowman's capsule. This is the proximal convoluted tubule. And what kind of substance do you find in the proximal convoluted tubule? It is filtrate. Not quite urine yet. It is filtrate. So, in the proximal convoluted tubule, its job is to resorb water, but leave all kinds of junk that was in your blood that you want to get rid of. All right, so it's resorbing water. All right, glucose also leaks out of Bowman's, of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. And do you want to lose glucose in the urine? No. So that's another job of the proximal convoluted tubule, is to resorb glucose and put it back into the blood. All right. So that's the proximal convoluted tubule. This is in the cortex of the kidney. Then the tubule drops deep down into the medulla and forms this big loop right here. This is what we call a loop of Henle. Loop of Henle. And you can see it's got two parts. It's got a descending limb and an ascending limb. So, for instance, this one right here, where the cursor is, right here, is that the ascending or descending? Okay. That is the ascending limb. Ascending limb. So let's take a look. And how are you going to know if it's ascending or descending? Always trace it back to Bowman's capsule or the glomerular capsule. Because depending on the figure, it could be flipped back and forth, so always trace it back. You learn structures by the relationship to other structures. So here is Bowman's capsule. You know for sure this is the proximal convoluted tubule, so this has got to be the descending loop, and this is the ascending loop. All right, and then we got a couple more structures. Another segment of twists and turns right here, that is the distal convoluted tubule. How about if I just abbreviate it? Distal, DCT. And then finally, that fluid, the filtrate, is going to empty the collecting duct, and now we actually consider that urine. It's been processed into urine. And it goes from the collecting duct to the tip of a renal pyramid and then into a minor calyx and into a major calyx and down through the renal pelvis into the ureter, finally into the urinary bladder. All right, so those are the things that you have to be aware of. So, should we try this? Should we try this thing over here? Oh, I don't have a control key on my mouse. So let me come over here. So if you hit control, look what you get. No, I mean up there, what do you get? You get a little executable link symbol, right? If we click on that, I don't know if I did it right. Oh no, and I got to go find it again. Rats. Where was it? Oh, close. We're close. Here. Okay. Did I delete it? No. Oh, maybe it popped up someplace. Control, hand, click. It's supposed to just pop up. Okay, I can do that too. I like it. Thanks for these suggestions. Okay. All right, so copy. Maybe I wasn't hitting the control button. No, I've got the hand right there. Okay, so if you can't get to an internet access and get that figure or any of these figures, you got to let me know, because I'll provide, because you don't have this figure in your textbook. All right, so if you need to, I got to paste it, sorry. Now I got to do something else. What do I got to do? I got to say go. Okay. All right. So if you can't get to the internet to download this picture, you got to let me know, and I'll give you a photocopy of it for you to practice. Because this is definitely something that could be on your test coming up on the 15th. All right. So this is it right here. All right. So let's start at the beginning. What's the name of this thing? This is the. It's on your board right there. That's the afferent arteriole, and if you want to double check, all you got to do is click. Afferent arteriole, 100%. This one here is the efferent arteriole, right? Here's the efferent arteriole. Now, where is the glomerulus? That's this thing right here, which is down here. Glomerulus, right? And what is surrounding the glomerulus? That is the That is the Bowman's capsule, or you could say glomerular capsule. Okay, so we got the glomerular. What's the name of the second capillary bed? This structure right here, the red and the blue. That's the peritubular capillaries, right? All right, so that's pretty much it for what kind of element inside the nephron. The vascular elements, all right? And here is the first part of a tubular element, Bowman's capsule. So what is this right here? That's the PCT, all right? And then this is the descending loop of Henle, ascending loop of Henle, and here is the DCT, and then here is the collecting duct. All right, so you can just practice this and, all right, easy 100% on the test. All right, so what's another good way of practicing this diagram? Well, you know what? There's actually something I want to do before we practice. All right, and that is talk about the processes by which urine is formed. And there are three processes by which urine is formed. So here is that afferent arteriole bringing blood into the glomerulus. And the first step is when plasma leaks out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. That's what we call glomerular filtration. Just like when you make coffee in the morning, that's just due to a pressure gradient that can move through the wall of the glomerulus. Okay, then in the remaining of the nephron, you have special cells that can take things that your body needs from the filtrate and put it back into the blood. Name, give me two things that your body needs that you don't want to end up in urine. Water, number one, and glucose, yeah, sugar, number two. So this process of taking stuff from the filtrate, putting it back in the blood, is what we call tubular reabsorption. You're reabsorbing those materials back into your body. And then also, in the rest of the nephron, there still remain some things that are in blood that your body doesn't want, toxic materials. Right? And it's going to take these substances from the blood and put it into the filtrate. And could you think of some substances that you don't need in your blood that your nephron is going to put into the filtrate? The one thing that we mentioned before was urea, because it's toxic. But if you have excess of other kinds of things, excess sodium or excess potassium, the kidneys can excrete these substances before they're harmful to you, as well as acid. So the kidneys can excrete acid because it can move hydrogen ions by the process of tubular secretion. So don't forget, filtration goes from blood to filtrate, reabsorption goes from filtrate to blood, and secretion goes from blood to filtrate. Those are the three steps. And when the whole nephron is done doing its job, then that filtrate becomes urine. Yeah, so those are the three steps. All right, so this board is kind of a mess, but I think you can see if I draw that out. And maybe we'll do this on the test. All right, so here could be a good instruction. Now I'll draw it up over here because this board over here is pretty clean. All right, so here could be a nice instruction. Draw the structural and functional unit of urine formation. Okay, so you know what that is, right? All right, okay. Use all of the following to draw and label. Can't just draw and label. Be sure to use all of the following to label your diagram. So what are some things that we gotta do? Afferent arterial, glomerulus, efferent arterial, peritubular capillary. All right, and then we gotta have what? Bowman's capsule, proximal convoluted tubule, descending loop of Henle, ascending loop of Henle, distal convoluted tubule. This reminds me a lot of that spinal cord that we did. Distal convoluted tubule, collecting duct. Oh, and I left something out. Okay, and I'll put it here. Show three processes of urine formation. So what are the three processes of urine formation? We've got filtration, tubular reabsorption, and tubular secretion. And I think that's it. I don't think I left anything out. Maybe I left something out. Let's see, do I have a blue marker? So let's draw this out real quick. What should we start first with? How about the tubular elements first? Okay. Tubular elements first. So what do we got? What's that? Bowman's capsule. And then what? Proximal convoluted tubule. Doing the descending loop of Henle. Ascending loop of Henle. And then what? Distal, the DCT going into the collecting duct. That's pretty easy. Okay. And then we got some vascular elements. Like here, this is the afferent arteriole going into here. This is the glomerulus coming out. Efferent arteriole. And then what do we got? We got all this stuff, this network of blood vessels here. Too bad I don't have a red marker, but I can't tell anyway. So this is what? The peritubular capillaries. And then this is just going to go to the renal vein. All right, so that's the nephron right there. That's the tubular elements, vascular elements. Now what about the three processes? How about going from here into here? Number one, tubular filtration. What about going from here back into the blood? Yeah, let's say that's two, right? Two is tubular reabsorption. Yeah, I believe that. And then how about going from here into here? Tubular secretion. Tubular secretion. Okay, so don't forget, tubular filtration is blood to filtrate. Tubular reabsorption is filtrate to blood. And tubular secretion is blood to filtrate. That's probably good to make a note of, that you can see that. Okay. I'll put B to F or F to B. Tubular filtration happens here. Filtration goes from blood to filtrate. And tubular reabsorption is from filtrate to blood. So this is F to B. And tubular secretion is right here. Three. It's from blood putting noxious compounds into the filtrate for excretion. So tubular secretion is blood to filtrate. Did I mix them up? Yeah, you just flip it around. So if you keep that structure, just go like that. Okay, but you should have a pretty clear picture. Yeah. It can happen pretty much all over the place. I would say more in the distal parts of the nephron, and maybe even a little bit of the collecting duct. Okay? Yeah. Okay. So go ahead, practice drawing it. Use the interactive exercise a couple times, and then practice drawing it out. And how long will it take you to draw that out? Not long. How about let's see how long it takes me to draw it out. Let's just do it one more time. See if I have a couple markers that still work. All right, so maybe start with tubular elements. All right, who's going to time me? I'll time myself. Okay, ready? You guys should do this too as I do it. Ready? Go. All right, so here is Bowman's capsule. Proximal convoluted tubule. Descending loop of Henle. Ascending loop of Henle. Distal convoluted tubule, collecting duct. Okay, and then we got what? The afferent arteriole going into the glomerulus, coming out the efferent arteriole to the peritubular capillaries, okay, to the renal vein, and then the processes. What are the processes? I'm bogging down. What's this? Tubular filtration. And from here to here, tubular reabsorption. And what about from here to here? Tubular secretion. 54 seconds. I mean, because you're going to see something like this on the practicum, and if you can draw it all out in less than a minute, you're going to be bored out of your minds during the practicum. Okay, so practice that up. But on the practicum, make sure you follow these ascending and descending loops back to the glomerulus to make sure you know which one is which. Right? Okay, because every diagram is going to be different. Well, I guess we didn't quite finish urinary system, but we will next time. All right, so you can't get onto Blackboard or something, maybe you should see me right after class, and I'll see what the problem might be. All right? And always check your registration. If there's a problem, make sure you let me know. So that's it for today. Anybody have a last question? No? Okay. You know, I'm going to have to be, I'll show you the figure of the lymph node next time. Or tomorrow. Yeah. Because it's not exactly like what's in your book. You have an updated version of it. Okay.